You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1995 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the fourth class in a series given by Brother Alan Eyre on the subject, The Word Made Flesh. This class is titled, Golgotha.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. We're going to open with a hymn, 170. We'll remain seated. When I survey the wondrous cross. A few years ago, we had a picture in our Caribbean Pioneer magazine. It was a reproduction of a very well-known painting. Just slips me now the particular famous Italian painter, but it was a very well-known picture of the crucifixion. And we asked readers if they could identify errors, mistakes on the picture, things wrong with it. The best list we got was 23 items on the picture which were wrong, unscriptural, or unlikely to be unscriptural, which indicates perhaps how our concepts, our pictures of biblical events can be coloured by tradition, by imagination, in some cases by pure fantasy. I remember a few of the items that were mentioned. The cross itself was a beautifully, it was a lovely piece of carpentry. You know, 4x4 dressed lumber, you know. Nicely squared and all that. It wasn't, you know. As it says, it was a tree. Just that. Probably with the bark still on it. They wouldn't bother stripping it off and all that. It certainly wasn't squared. It was a tree. Perhaps with some nasty snags in it, as you call them in this country. Just piece sawn off to make a cross beam and then hammered into place. And then Jesus, you know, he wasn't up there like the pictures show him, and the thieves on either side. During the course of the crucifixion, he was given by a bystander a sponge with vinegar on a hyssop. And you'd have a hard time finding a hyssop more than a foot long. Right? You stick a sponge on a foot long twig and offer it to a man's mouth. How high is he going to be? 2 feet? 3 feet off the ground? No. 18 inches maybe. He was here, not up there. So when they were mocking him and saying, come down from the cross, they weren't looking up like this, you know. They were just below his head. They could easily throw their bad eggs. Right. They could spit in his face if they wanted, and probably did. And there is a green hill far away, without a city wall. It wasn't green, you know. And it wasn't a hill either. It was a cemetery. It was the place of a skull. That's what it was. Near the cemetery was a garden with a bit of an annex where rich Jews built rather fancier tombs for themselves. They were in a garden. That was nearby, but that wasn't the place of a skull. I guess that was where the criminals finished up. And there were many other things wrong with that picture. Because, of course, the aim of the picture was to try to glorify the crucifixion. We just sang a hymn, "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross." What is there wondrous about a gallows? Yes, of course it was wondrous, only because of what took place there. But it's a figure of speech, of course, because there's nothing wondrous about an instrument of execution. Of course, the hymn writer wasn't thinking in that literal term. He was thinking of the act of love which it represented. But we ought to remember that most of the time that we speak about the death of Christ and what went on at Calvary, Golgotha, is in figurative language. Most of it. And this has been the biggest stumbling block to understanding the death of Christ throughout the centuries since it took place. That wonderful psalm that we read a while ago, oh, if only it was true, or had been true. The psalmist says, "The Lord is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and rich in love. The Lord is good to all. He has compassion on all he has made. The Lord is faithful to all his promises and loving towards all he has made." And Golgotha set the seal upon that loving kindness of God. And so the psalmist says, as a result of that, all you have made will praise you. Your saints will extol you. They will tell of the glory of your kingdom and speak of all your might, so that men may know of your mighty acts. They will celebrate your abundant goodness and joyfully sing of your righteousness. They will tell of the power of your awesome works and proclaim your great deeds. Oh, if that had been true, you would think that Golgotha was so awesome, as the word is used there, an expression of God's love and compassion to us, that all those who could appreciate it would have done what the psalmist says there. They would have been ready to celebrate that goodness and proclaim the beauty of that love as expressed in the death of Christ. Instead of which, for 20 centuries, it has been a subject of endless controversy Men have even fought on the battlefield over different conceptions of what God did on Golgotha. Pathetic. I mentioned about books on the letter to the Romans filling a whole wall. But I can tell you, if you look up in the newly computerized catalogue of the Library of Congress and put in atonement or Calvary or death of Christ, you'd be having the paper coming out of the printer for about half an hour. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of books. The ink that has been used to explain, confound, and argue about what God did with His beloved Son on Golgotha. And we cannot ourselves stand in any judgment, can we? The bitterest feuds we have had among us have almost always raged on this topic. And yet the psalmist says, what we should do is celebrate God's abundant goodness. Joyfully sing of His righteousness. Let's be a disciple for a moment, one of the 12. And listen to Jesus. When they came together in Galilee, Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill Him. And on the third day, He will be raised to life." And the disciples were filled with grief. A little later, as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, He took the 12 disciples aside and said to them, "We are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn Him to death and will turn Him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. On the third day, He will be raised to life." You know what event took place immediately after that statement? The mother of Zebedee's children came to Jesus with her sons and, kneeling down, said, "Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom." My teacher used to say to me that sometimes things went in at one ear and out at the other, but that was nothing to this, was it? Why were they so incomprehending, eh? But when the tenants saw the son, they said to each other, "This is the heir. Come, let's kill him and take his inheritance." So they took him and threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. Then he took the cup, gave thanks, and offered it to them, saying, "Drink ye all of it. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." Jesus said, "The one who has dipped his hand in the bowl with me will betray me. The Son of Man will go just as it is written about him. The poor you will have always with you, but you will not always have me." What would you be feeling? Each nail driven home, I am going to die. And the third day, I will rise again. But it's not just to die, is it? Let's go back to the worst one, if you might put it that way. The worst one. It must have seemed like that to us. The Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests. Not the Romans. The rulers of his own people. And the teachers of the law. The religious leaders. They will condemn him to death. The implication being it would be a judicial trial. And will turn him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. My Master, my Lord, the Messiah. No wonder they were incomprehending. No wonder Peter would go to him and say, Lord, this shall not be unto thee. You're a fool. You can't go up to Jerusalem. That's no Messiah. Get thee behind me, Satan. Thou art an offence unto me. Thou savourest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men. We have to ask, brothers and sisters, why the betrayal? Why the mocking? Why the flogging? And why the cross? It cries out for an answer. And it's one of the hardest problems that any believer has to answer. It was very hard, you know, being a disciple in the first century. Sometimes Christadelphians, because we try to base our faith upon the first century believers and the first century church, we tend to think that it was some golden age of the truth. Nonsense. It was a very, very difficult time to be a believer. And one of the biggest problems of all was to present the truth. Just that, to present the truth. Because the truth was shameful. The truth was almost horrible. You had to portray your faith in a man who was a nobody, who was a condemned criminal, who was shamefully mocked and flogged and treated as a worthless individual by all the rulers of the day. Finally, given a slave's execution, nailed to a piece of wood, and given the death that was well known in those days. And if you ever remember the film Spartacus, you'd remember that slave rebellion ended by the Romans crucifying, I think it was about 3,000 people. On the road from Cumae to Rome, on either side of the road. It was a well-known end for a worthless scamp, you might say. And you had to try and present the idea that this individual was the savior of the world. It was hard. If you read some of the things that were written in opposition to the Christians, and there are many of them preserved. The contempt that educated Romans and Greeks and Jews felt for the Christians comes out from every page. It was very hard proclaiming a crucified Christ. So why? Why the cross? Why the shame? It is not easy for a loving father, any loving father, to see his son treated abominably by other men. During the Marxist period in Jamaica, of which I can speak with some experience, it was not unknown for that to happen. It happened to my own daughter. They almost killed her. Not in front of our eyes. Otherwise, I don't suppose I'd be here today, but because they tortured her to try to find out from her where we were. And just that very day, we'd gone to a meeting, which we didn't normally go, and just so happened providentially that was the day they came. It's not easy to see one you love spitted on, tortured, and above all subjected to this most shameful of all executions, perhaps in history. Why? We have to answer if we are to understand the love of God. It's not something to argue about. We've done too much of that. Something to marvel at. Something to bow down in humble adoration to the God of heaven for. But we must try to understand it in some degree. Let's turn to Isaiah 53, which of course was the chapter that most early Christians used. But let's put this chapter in perspective, brothers and sisters. Let's put it in the right place, as the rather crude saying has it. Let's not put the cart before the horse. Jesus did not die because, or in the way that the scriptures said. He didn't say, well, I know that because it says this, therefore I must go through the motions of doing it, because it has to be fulfilled. When he said the scriptures must be fulfilled, he didn't mean that. He can't have meant that. That he went through the motions of fulfilling something that was written on a page of a scroll. No, it's the other way round. It was written prophetically because the inspired writers had been told that it would happen. The prophecies looked forward to it. They were there because of what would come to pass, not the other way round. What took place on Calvary did not take place because the scriptures had in some predetermined way set the stage and it had to be fulfilled in that fashion in order for the scriptures to be fulfilled. That's not what is meant at all. Here was a picture of what faithful men were to look for when it came. He was despised and rejected by men.
a man of sorrows, familiar with suffering. Like one whom men hide their faces from, he was despised and we esteemed him not. I grant you that if all of us here were at Golgotha, I doubt if half of us would dare look at Jesus. I wouldn't. I can't take it. Some people faint at the sight of blood, you know. Never mind a crucifixion. Like one whom men hide their faces from, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he took our infirmities and carried our sorrows. Yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed or bruised, the same word in Genesis, of course, for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him. And by his wounds, we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. The Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. So in some way, all these horrible things that happened in AD 29 in Jerusalem were for me. For me. Many theories have, of course, been invented. Many figures have been used to explain it. And Jesus himself used a figure of speech, which I think we ought to look at. Back to Matthew's Gospel, chapter 20, verse 27. And whoever wants to be first, this is the context, of course, is there of the argument about who would be the greatest. Whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. It's a figure. It's not literal, of course, as many people seem to be misled to think. It's a picture based upon the culture of the time, the culture of slavery. If a man gave his life a ransom for another, it was quite an understandable thing in those days. A slave was bound to his master and could not free himself. But if another came and either paid the value of that slave to the master so that he would not lose the value of that man's service, or offered himself, he could free that man from his bondage. And it's a figure. And it's a figure which runs right through the New Testament. It's particularly developed in the letter to the Romans, where in a very elaborate and extended figure, the Apostle Paul presents our bondage, our slavery, as a slavery to sin, as if sin is a master, a cruel master who has us in his bondage. We are all slaves to him from birth to death. And Jesus frees us by his obedience, his death, his life. But that doesn't explain the pain, does it? He doesn't explain the shame, the cruelty of the death, the torture. That's a harder problem. One of the biggest problems in the early church was to try to explain that. As I said, it was hard because people mocked at those who believed in a crucified Messiah. And unfortunately, they developed certain theologies which made the matter far worse. They tried to glorify Jesus until he almost, I think there's a bit of a problem with some light here. And what many of the theologians in the early church did was to quietly suppress the nastier aspect, shall we say, of the crucifixion, and gradually elevate the person of Christ until eventually they made him God himself, a Trinity. It's a process that took about 300 years. But the reason, we often don't understand the reason. They didn't do that because they were just wanted to be apostate, or they wanted to just change the truth for the sake of it. The reason they did it is because they were ashamed to preach and teach and even believe in a Jesus, a Messiah, a Savior, who was treated like that. People would not accept it. People found it hard to accept it. And so they had to try to portray Jesus in a much better light, you know, a much more glorified light. So little by little, under the pressure of the pagan hostility to the truth about Jesus, they gradually got to the point where they started putting halos around him, as you see from the pictures. And little by little, he was transformed into a god. Some god that would be acceptable to attract the pagans to Christianity. And little by little, they forgot the real meaning of what went on at Calvary. And of course that has come down to our own day. There is a very popular book by Henry Morris called Bible Answers to Common Questions. It's very popular in the United States. I think Henry Morris has a reputation much higher than he deserves, but that's a fairly well known book. And one of the questions he deals with is, was it possible for Jesus to sin? He quotes Hebrews 2, which makes it quite clear that it was. And then Morris, after some awkward beating about the bush, argues that it was not possible for Jesus to sin because he was God. Once you assume that Jesus is God, you have all sorts of problems explaining Calvary and how his perfect life and his shameful death was anything other than a stage trick. If Jesus is God, then his perfect life is no longer such a remarkable achievement, is it? And his death becomes utterly inexplicable. And so they even developed a considerable body of belief, which is still held today by many Christians, called Docetism, which meant that Jesus only seemed
to suffer on Calvary. He went through a charade there in Jerusalem. But really, he wasn't doing it. It was a kind of stage show. And of course, inevitably, that led to the substitutionary death of Christ as an explanation. And worst of all, to the idea that the death of Christ on Calvary, all the suffering, all the pain, all the anguish, all the shame, was just a way to appease an angry God the Father. And that God the Father would see what Jesus, the God the Son, went through and would say, enough, enough, I'll save mankind. And yet, as an Anglican, that's what I was asked to believe when I was a youngster. We are very fortunate, brothers and sisters, that we have a much more scriptural outlook on the truth. Even the most carefully worked out theory, which treats Jesus as somehow God himself or a part of the Godhead, is really a caricature and a stumbling block to us understanding what went on at Golgotha. And what went on really is explained by one phrase, I believe, that Jesus used over and over. Follow me. We cannot understand the cross unless we accept that that's where we are going, ourselves. We cannot understand it. It is not something done instead of me. Jesus didn't hang on the cross to make sure that I didn't go there. We have to go there. And he said so. Take up your cross and follow me. The reason for the pain, the reason for the shame, the reason for the agony, for the mocking, for the scourging, is that we may understand, that we may need to accept all of that if we're going to follow him. Because beyond it, as with him, lies the glory. He died as our forerunner, as our example. He died as a sacrifice, but not instead of us, but to show us that we must sacrifice if we are to live forever. There is no other way. Jesus made it quite clear. And we'll take up that theme tomorrow.